from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Just how much food do you figure we waste every year as a country? Well, it's hard to calculate this, but the activist Tristram Stewart has tried. It's like an equation. You start with the food supply, and you figure out how much of it is actually being consumed. Add it up, and we're wasting something like 40% of the food we're producing. And Stewart says, if you think about all that abundance, all of that surplus in the scope of human history, it's a success story. But he says, we have to realize we've reached a limit to what the planet can bear. All that waste, he says, has some devastating costs. Today in the program, we're talking about food waste with Tristram Stewart. And here's a good place to start. How much perfectly good food are you throwing out? Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including cardiology, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer treatment. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of you have a mother or a grandmother who simply will not let food go to waste. Maybe they were children of war or depression. Maybe they grew up poor. They'll keep a dollop of this or that on a plate in the fridge for a casserole or something. And they put us all to shame, those of us who let the lettuce get wilty or the bread get stale. We think nothing of just tossing it. It's easy to start over. Grocery stores in this country are emblems of abundance. But Tristram Stewart is asking us to think more about the costs of this kind of waste. Most of the food we ditch ends up in a landfill where it breaks down and becomes some kind of greenhouse gas. And think of the energy that went into planting it and watering it and transporting it. And put all of that aside for just a moment. The tons and tons and tons of wasted food, 40% of our food we waste. Put that aside for a sec. And think of the nearly 1 billion undernourished people in the world. Stewart says by wasting food, we're stealing it from the world's common resources. Tristram Stewart is our guest today. We're talking about food waste. He's the founder of Feedback. It's a UK-based nonprofit that campaigns to end food waste. He's also the author of the book Waste, Uncovering the Global Food Waste Scandal. He joined us from a studio in New York City. I wanted to begin, it seems like you've been thinking about the idea of sustainability, these kinds of things, from an early age, and I'm wondering where this came from. Was it something at home? Was there a kind of epiphany you came to really young about this kind of thing?
It's too early for me to remember when I became an environmentalist. I know that when I was 12, I wrote my school dissertation on climate change.
Wow.
And that was my passion by then. I had never really found it difficult to see how I as an individual fitted into the global significance of what was coming, the calamity of the destruction of the ecosphere and the forests and what we were doing to the climate. And it became really my central passion. And even before that, actually, I grew up in a beautiful part of the world in southern England, surrounded by forests and fields and wild nature. My father had made it his hobby to know every species of every different organism that grew there, and he shared that with us. I was hunting mushrooms and taking adults on mushroom forages by the age of 4. So I think it's just always been there, and it's always been central. And the love of nature, which I think lies at the heart of what we're trying to do, had always determined what I was going to try and achieve in my life.
I couldn't quite tell in the book. Was your father a farm manager, a farmer himself?
Oh, no. My father had been far too ill for most of his life to do anything like that. He'd grown up on a pre-war farm where, you know, there were enough farm laborers to send out a cricket team against the local village. And I loved those stories of his growing up on a mixed farm, working in the fields. And that wasn't his life, though. He was an English teacher. He wrote a couple of books. He was dedicated to literature and sharing of his passion and his understanding of literary works, something he passed on to me. I always wanted to be a a writer, an environmentalist, and I wanted to be a farmer. But the farm itself, which was a tiny, totally unviable economic unit in the modern day, was pretty much empty. The farmyard had nothing in it. The fields were rented out to a nearby farmer for, you know, pretty much nothing. And just at the age of 15, I wanted to recreate some of the scene that I'd heard about from my father's childhood.
Huh.
And I saved up some money. I bought one pig, a female sow, for £90, which was a lot of money to me back then.
Right.
And then I borrowed the boar off the nearby farmer and got my sow pregnant and started breeding pigs. And I was given by my father 12 purebred light Sussex chickens, and I fed both the pigs and the chickens on food waste. I then got ferrets to go catching rabbits in the forest and in the fields, and that was my farmyard. It wasn't anyone else's. It was my little enterprise.
At what point did you start actually thinking about didn't seem like this was an experiment to see how much waste was out there. It was something else. When did that occur to you, the idea of waste?
Oh, the idea of waste occurred to me because the price of pig feed was completely prohibitive. I was never going to make any money. I remember when I first started buying it, I calculated how much I was going to spend. And of course, that is the reality that most pig farmers in Europe and indeed in the US have faced. It's almost unviable unless you are on a massive scale to make any money. You make a loss. And in addition to that, I was aware even then that it was the production of cereals and protein feeds globally that was putting pressure on the land, that was ultimately driving deforestation in places like South America. And the idea of feeding my pigs on the spoils of the most biodiverse natural landscape in the world really just didn't sit well. And of course, I knew that traditionally, in my father's day and for millennia before that, pigs weren't fed on specially grown grains. Yeah. They were fed on the waste from our food system. And
in fact, we domesticated them for that purpose, I guess, right?
Absolutely. Indeed, one can only speculate, but one can imagine that, as with many domestications, this was not a question so much of people going out and capturing pigs and putting a fence around them. It was pigs coming to our settlements and foraging around in our waste heaps. And that almost mutual relationship, they are waste, we feed them with our waste. Obviously, we kill them and eat them. But nevertheless, the species of pig has thrived in partnership with humans. You can find pigs more or less everywhere in the world that you can find humans, with a few notable interesting exceptions. So really, it seemed like the most natural thing in the world for me to go down to my school kitchens and ask if they could keep aside the leftovers that my school friends had turned their noses up at. I sent them in, you know, pork chops every time I slaughtered my pigs. But they were really doing it because why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
They had all of this waste.
Yeah.
They didn't like trashing it. And here was one of the school kids wanting to take it home to feed their pigs. I also went down to the local baker, and they started saving several sacks of bread every week. I used to collect them. And the local market, I used to go and pick up a carload of cauliflower leaves. And, you know, I started just foraging around, spoke to a farmer who was wasting the potatoes because they were the wrong shape or size, perfectly good potatoes, bartered them with the eggs. And then, of course, my father had a vegetable patch, a very extensive vegetable garden. And I used to barter with him. He gave me any of the kind of offcuts from the garden, and I gave him manure from my pigs.
Yeah.
So I had a really nice setup.
There's a lovely story you tell in the book about this moment when you actually sort of sat down with the pigs. I think it was a tomato loaf that you consumed with them. And I'm not sure if it was an epiphanal moment, but it certainly is what you call your first act of freeganism.
Yeah, that was a real thing that happened to me. And it has become kind of iconic in my mental landscape. I do very clearly remember I'd been picking up this bread for months, and the smell of the bread was, yeah, it was like being in a bakery, delicious. And a lot of the bread was just from the day before, it was still perfectly soft. And again, when I was hungry one of these days and I was picking up one of these big loaves of bread. It just seemed like the most obvious thing that I should eat it myself.
Right.
So I did. And it was delicious. It was much nicer than the bread my dad was buying in supermarkets. It was just him and me at home. And that I remember that combination of both pleasure, the sense of, I guess, a hunter-gatherer is always after free food. I'd been foraging and hunting in the forest all my life, and here was this abundance of food, and that kind of trigger of, yeah, free food, loads of it,
right,
was combined with also the kind of disquiet, the anger that everywhere I'd looked, there was food being wasted, and some people wanted to cooperate, and some people just wanted to sweep it under the carpet, frankly. That frustration, I remember going into the supermarket in the local town, talking to the manager, and he was being so hedgy and kind of secretive, and he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't even want to admit it existed, and I'd been around the back, I'd seen in the bins, and there was all this food in there, and he didn't want to do anything about it. And, you know, I was a hot-headed teenager, and it became a mission for me to change that.
It's interesting, when you first really started being an activist in all of this, you say there was practically no information about food waste. And I can't figure out why.
Well, the big corporations who are responsible for most of the food being wasted in their supply chains and in their own stores, they knew that everyone else would be just as angry as I was if they'd known that literally on the very street where homeless shelters are feeding hungry people and, you know, there not being enough food and everyone's saying, yeah, we need more food in the world. They knew perfectly well that it would be a scandal if the public, if their consumers, if the citizens of the world knew just how much perfectly good food they were throwing away on a daily basis and were resisting any kind of move to change. So it was a cover-up. And indeed, when I, after years of really feeding myself almost primarily out of the supermarket bins in the university town where I studied, I left university. I was a dedicated environmental activist. And I thought, well, this issue is firstly not at all known about. There's nothing in the press about it, literally nothing. I'd searched, and there was occasional stories about the great food redistribution organizations who were picking up surplus food and feeding it to the hungry and giving it to food pantries and the rest of it. And that existed. Of course, that's existed for decades. But it hadn't been made into this issue, a challenge to the industry. And, you know, land and our management of it as a species has always been the most important thing to me, and it is arguably the single biggest challenge that humanity still has to face. We all have got used to talking about the climate change negotiations and the need to bring down carbon emissions from industry and transport, and of course that is absolutely essential. But even more essential, and what needs to be achieved simultaneously, is to protect the world's remaining forests and other wild places, because without them, we do not have the lungs of the earth.
Yeah.
Without them, we do not have the habitat for all the other species on this planet to survive. Without them, we do not have the water cycle that provides us with fresh water. And yet, the agricultural frontier is pushing further and further into these places. In my own lifetime, half of all wildlife has been exterminated. And by current trajectories, within a century, there will be none left at all. That is all being done in the quest to grow more food.
Yeah.
You can read the literature from Monsanto and Cargill, these massive food corporations, and even international institutions like the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, and they coalesce around what I call the dominant paradigm in the food system, the productionist paradigm. They're saying we need to double food production by 2050 to feed those 9 billion people that are projected to be on planet Earth by then. My argument is that that is not just wrong, it is actually the single biggest threat to long-term food security, because the only way in which we can achieve that, the only way in which we are achieving that, is by extending the agricultural frontier.
Yeah.
Let me qualify that. There are some technological innovations. If you look at hyper-intensive agriculture in countries like Holland, if you look at the promises that are being delivered, or being promised rather, by the genetic engineering industry, there's opportunities for increasing yield, but doubling food production is not even on the horizon through those technologies. It's being done in the way that will undermine the viability of life on Earth, which underwrites our agricultural system. If we screw that up, we really could end up with a very serious food shortage on planet Earth.
I want to ask you about the sort of the philosophical, ethical underpinnings of this, because you write about John Locke, for example. You refer to Locke, who said that if we waste food, we essentially lose the right to own food. That in essence, this seems like a theme in the book that you get at, that we're all in essence, if we're wasting food, stealing it from the world's common resources. I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
That's right. I think it also comes back to the land. Private ownership of land is a really relatively recent concept. Now, I'm not saying that we need to undo the concept of private ownership of land in order to save the planet, but I do say that, and this is what Locke was arguing, the argument for enclosing land was because by giving private ownership over a piece of land, you incentivize an individual to invest in it through their labor, through fertilizing it, and other improvements, and you increase yield. And that increase in yield is a common good. You've provided onto the market something that people want. And that was the underpinning for enclosures, for taking common land, land that had been held in common by everyone, and privatizing it, essentially. And that is the ideology of privatization generally. And what he's saying is, look, if you're going to use that as the basis for mass land enclosure, the premise requires you to grow that food and to make it available. If you enclose the land and you grow food and you let it go to waste, you have not provided the good that justifies the privatization of that asset, and thereby you destroy your own argument. And my point in my book was, well, look at what we're doing now. A third of all the world's food is being grown in exactly that way and is being wasted. And at the same time, we prevent people who need it from taking it. You just need to look at the supermarket garbage cans that are locked tight, under lock and key. Staff who are found trying to do something about it are fired. People who rummage in bins are arrested, criminalized. Shop managers sometimes even pour bleach over the food to prevent people from taking the food out, let alone what's going on in the fields. If you are hungry and just read Grapes of Wrath and you try to kind of go and get food from the orchard, you're a criminal.
Yeah.
And, you know, that situation is not just morally untenable. It's something that I don't think anyone really would agree is the right way to manage our resources.
There's this thought experiment you propose in your book where you say, imagine living in a closed room with five other people. One of these people is malnourished, and one is a much more powerful, you know, much more wealthy than the rest. And that person is eating way more than everyone else. And what you're saying, I like this thought experiment because it made me think that essentially we all live in that closed room, or that's a good way of thinking about it anyway.
Yeah. Actually, the ratio I gave was seven people in the room, and that's kind of representative of the 7 billion people that were on the planet at that point. Two of those people are powerful and wealthy. That's the 2 billion that live in rich countries and already eat more than is good for them and waste, you know, a third of what they have or even more. And then there are two representing the 2 billion underfed, the 1 billion. You're right, yes. The one person who is underfed. And what we're doing is throwing food out of the window while one of those people are hungry. But what I go on to say is that whilst that feels kind of almost depressing in its moral weight, as do all of these other ecological hazards that we're talking about. Whilst that is scandalous and tragic, the great thing about this issue is that the solution is enjoyable. It's something we can celebrate, something we can do with each other that is just nourishing both to our moral and social and obviously our physical bodies, and that is to eat and enjoy and share our food with each other. I've started doing an event which I call the Bonobo Feast. And you know what bonobos are? They're our closest animal relative, the pygmy chimpanzees. When they have surplus food, they proactively or pro-socially share it. They will go out and find people to share it with, other bonobos. But what's really interesting about them, and what I think humans have to learn from them, is that they select strangers to share their food with over friends.
Wow.
That seems counterintuitive, but what they're doing is turning surplus food into social capital and making new friends with them, with that extra banana or whatever. Think of all the friends we could make with the 1.3 billion tons of food that humans currently waste every year.
Yeah.
And so I organize bonobo feasts, and the one rule is that you're not allowed to feed yourself. You've got to feed somebody else.
Tristram Stewart, he's the founder of Feedback. It's a nonprofit group campaigning to end food waste. We have a link to that on our website. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the food we waste. Basically, it's a third of it. A third of the food we produce and buy is wasted because of ridiculous food expiration dates, because some fruits and vegetables aren't shaped just right, because we don't really think about it. Tristram Stewart has been fighting the world's food waste problem since he was a teenager. He's the founder of Feedback. It's a nonprofit group that campaigns to end food waste. He's also the author of the book Waste, Uncovering the Global Food Waste Scandal. It's interesting, you mention in your book the studies that show we're all under this illusion that we're wasting a lot less than we are. I wonder why that is.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, a whole load of things come into play, I think. When we buy food and we have good intentions around it, both to eat it and eat healthily, and then we don't meet our own expectations, it's something that, we don't feel comfortable about. And the things that we feel uncomfortable about or vulnerable about, we hide from ourselves and from others. And it's not even a conscious thing. It's also the case that, you know, we are almost programmed by the food culture in which we live. To treat food like it is an infinite and expendable resource. We're taught that from an early age. We go into the supermarkets, we see food piled high as if it is an infinite abundance out there. And that is exactly what we are being deliberately sold. You know, one of the things that the multi-billion dollar food marketing teams out there have worked out is that there is a human impulse, an instinct, an ineradicable reaction to the perception of abundance.
Yeah.
And that perception drives us to take some of that abundance. And the reason for that is that for the last 2 million years, hominids have grown up in an environment of scarcity. It's been difficult to get enough food to nourish yourself, nourish your family, nourish your tribe. And therefore, whenever there is abundance, you go for it. You eat what you can, you store what you can, you save what you can, and you don't worry too much about a few bits of leftover. It's there and you've got to take it. And the problem is we now, in rich countries, are surrounded by that abundance day in, day out. Every meal, between meals, we're surrounded by that huge image that is projected to us. And it is the reason why buffets are covered in lavish dishes, the reason why supermarkets are heaving with every kind of produce in full shelves at all times, is because that's the single biggest marketing tool there is, because we take it. We have to take it. We're humans. That's what we're hardwired to do. And when we waste it, it's like, well, it's infinite, so who cares?
Yeah.
Of course, that infinity is an illusion. We live on a finite planet, and indeed, the drive to produce, sell more, is the single biggest impact that humans have on the natural world.
How much food do you figure we're wasting? Because there are these various studies, and you sound pretty skeptical of a lot of these studies, so it seems like you're trying to work this out for yourself.
Well, that's kind of true. My book, which I published in 2009, was the first attempt to make a global estimate for food waste.
Yeah.
And, of course, there were a few empirical studies where food waste had actually been measured, principally at household level, none at all at industry and commercial level. That was all secret. But at household level, the UK had measured how much food was actually in people's bins. The US government had done a bit of a kind of proxy study to look at the difference between food eaten and food purchased. So there was some data out there, but by and large, I had to use proxy data. And I looked at how much food was available, how much on average people were eating in each country, and how much people actually needed to consume. And the difference between food supply and food requirements represented just such a colossal percentage of the whole of food production, that I estimated that at least a third of the world's food was being wasted.
Mm.
Now, other organizations like the United Nations, the European Commission have commissioned other studies now, and pretty much everyone comes to around that figure through either the same or similar or different statistical analyses. So there has been something of a consensus around the idea that we're wasting around a third of the world's food. That represents about 1.3 billion tons of food every year. And it's not really a question of whether we're right to the nearest million or even 100 million tons. It's a lot. It's everywhere. And there's an awful lot we can do about it.
Yeah.
And that's where I put most of my emphasis. Not so much on the statistics.
Right.
In terms of my skepticism, you are right. There are lots of facts, figures, and data out there that I believe are almost intentionally bogus. And the principal culprit in that respect is we are all told that consumers are the biggest wasters. Now, consumers, or I prefer to think of them as people because they do things other than consume,
yeah.
Or we could call them citizens, one or the other,
right.
That they are disproportionately responsible. Now, that data, by and large, and it's been generated in a number of different countries, often in well-intentioned ways, has been generated in the following way. Studies are done to forensically examine the food in people's trash. And people sit in their homes, they do interviews, they weigh the chicken bones and the leftover muffins and yogurt pots, and they calculate all of that. And that data is, in the best studies, you can see what percentage of that is actual food and what percentage is organic waste that is not food. So tea bags, bones, apple cores, things that people are just not going to eat. I mean, I eat my apple cores, but yeah, I don't expect everyone. So that's organic waste. But then when you get this aggregated data that just includes everything, and then on the other side, you look at what the industry wastes, and no government in the world has forensically examined the bins behind the supermarkets, let alone in their supply chains. Mm-hmm. They just take the industry's word for it. And, you know, we know that humans, that individuals underestimate their food waste. I think we can probably expect the industry to do the same. So that's the first thing. And secondly, no one has measured the waste of food on farms in rich countries. And I can tell you from the studies that I and my non-profit organization Feedback have done internationally on the food that is being wasted in farms in the supply chains of our supermarkets. That is the single biggest area of waste.
Yeah.
And fruit and vegetables that are not perfectly looking or surplus to requirements and just left there to rot. No one's measured that. We've just started doing a measurement study in the United Kingdom. It's the first real one to do it. No one includes the waste of edible fish at sea. And before we reformed the law in Europe a couple of years ago, that was 40 to 50% of all fish caught in European waters were being chucked overboard. No one includes the waste of edible offal in slaughterhouses. And most importantly, no one counts the waste of food overseas in our supply chains. So when a Colombian banana farmer growing bananas for the USA wastes 20% of their bananas because they're not the right shape or size. None of that is counted against the US food industry. And therefore, of course, consumers, whose waste is entirely included, and the industry on the other side, where most of the waste is not included, you get a figure that suggests that consumers are disproportionately responsible for the problem of food waste. And, yeah, I call those figures out.
Yeah. I want to ask you about these sell-by dates and these best-before dates and these used-by dates. You say in your book that food poisoning is the boogeyman of the food industry. Would you talk a little bit about this? Like, where did we start to get these ideas? I can't tell if they're just strategies designed to make us throw food away and go buy more, or how it came about.
You certainly can regard the use of some dates as a cynical attempt to get people to buy food and then throw it away when it's still perfectly good.
Yeah.
But I don't actually think that's the dominant situation. Date labels in their origin, for sure, were introduced for protecting the consumer right. from being sold bad food, dangerous food, or just generally not very good food. But over time, they have become abused and misused. And when Feedback, my organization, came to the USA, we were funded by the Rockefeller Foundation to bring our campaigns here last year. What we identified as the single lowest hanging fruit in the entire problem of food waste was date labels. And it was specifically the fact that in the US, all of these companies are using different dates from each other. There was no uniformity, no common language. And even an expert could look at a date that said expires on or best before or use by or use until or edible. Yeah, every different – you could not tell what it actually meant. So how on earth could the general public – I mean, imagine if we were going around to gas stations and in one gas station we called it gasoline and in another gas station we call it petrol or something else. You would fill your engine with the wrong fuel.
Yeah.
And that's what we were looking at with the date label system when we said, look, yes, for sure – there needs to be legislation to impose uniformity on the use of date labels so that everyone speaks a common language. And we proposed a two-date system, one, the best before, which is a quality guarantee that does not imply that after that date the food is going to kill you. It's just that's the maximum freshness,
right.
but at your discretion thereafter. And then another, which is about food safety, and that's for higher-risk foods like, I don't know, chicken pate or something like that. And there you do want to say, look, it's actually probably better for you to not eat the food after this date or at least treat it extremely cautiously if you do. And we said, yeah, legislation is good, but and I should say that there were a number of other fantastic organizations in the USA who were working on this. So yeah. ReFed and NRDC and a team at Harvard, they were all looking at this and they were all looking at legislation. And we said, look, legislation is good, but the industry could just sit down together tomorrow
yeah.
without delay,
yeah.
get together, agree common language, and boom, a few months later, you're going to have much better situation. And pretty much everyone got behind that. And sure enough, several months later, the GMA and the FMI, that represents a big chunk of the food industry, sat down together. They agreed uniform date labels. And that is now going to be rolled out. So it's the kind of solution that we're talking about that is just so obvious, so easy, so win for everyone. And, yeah, it's
well,
time to get on with it.
It seems to me like one of the things you've pointed out is that often the solution is deregulation, not more regulation. So it seems like we could forego that political battle between liberals and conservatives, at least in this one point. Everyone could agree on that potentially, it seems.
Yeah, this is what people refer to as a Trump-proof issue.
Right.
It's so obviously like the right thing to do. It doesn't matter what your ideological perspective is. It's just common sense. And for sure, there are areas of opportunity that do involve deregulation. However, there are some areas where better regulation is necessary.
Yeah.
One of the things, the most transformative things that Feedback has achieved over the years is, well, we got through concerted effort of a number of great organizations, a law passed in the United Kingdom in 2013. And it was to address what we call unfair trading practices in the supply chain. Essentially, What we have in many countries is a very high degree of consolidated power at the retail end of the supply chain. So a few massive retailers have so much more power than their thousands of farmers all over the world that they mistreat that power. And one of the things that they do is cancel orders or amend forecasts so that farmers have grown food and then right before it's due to be delivered or brought to market, they say, oh, yeah, actually, we don't want it. We can get cheaper stuff from Guatemala, or people aren't buying it because it's raining or whatever. And all of that cost is offloaded onto the farmer who spent their life and their money growing the food. And this new law says you can't cancel an order at the last minute. You can't amend a forecast at the last minute and cause your supplier to lose money. And if you do that, you get fined up to 1% of your turnover as a company, which is a colossal fine, as well as all the reputational damage that will you'll incur through the media coverage when you are found out to have broken the law. And it's had a transformative effect. We took this campaign to Europe with a bunch of allies, and we've just achieved in the last few weeks an announcement from the commissioner in charge of food and agriculture, who has said that he's going to draw up a directive for Europe on this, and that will help to transform the European system. And I'm very pleased to say that when we came over to DC last year and we did one of our big celebratory events, Feeding the 5,000, where we kind of celebrate the wonderful, delicious and edible solutions to food waste. We feed 5,000 people at a time with food that would have been wasted, and we bring together all the great organizations who are working on this issue, food redistribution organizations, environmental organizations, policymakers, and really try to just inspire people to solve this problem. When we did that in DC, we got called into the House Ag Committee, and they were very, very interested in that piece of legislation that we got through in the United Kingdom, how it worked, whether it worked, what were its benefits, etc. So who knows? But certainly that issue persists here in the US.
Tristram Stewart, he's the founder of Feedback. It's a nonprofit group campaigning to end food waste. We have a link to that on our website. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. It's Doug Fabrizio. Let me play something for you real quick.
When I looked at myself in the mirror, I saw someone no good Mormon girl would ever marry. I saw someone who was losing the battle with Satan.
It's a man who recorded himself in his Mormon ward. KUER's Lee Hale found that tape, and you can hear our conversation about pornography in the Mormon church on our new podcast, More to Say, November 16th. Wherever you get your podcasts. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Tristram Stewart. Stewart is featured in a new documentary film produced in part by the food writer Anthony Bourdain. It's called Wasted. I'm trying to get a sense of what the cultural dimensions of this are. You tell a terrific story in Western China there, where you say there's this real taboo against food waste. And maybe you could mention it and just talk a little bit about why there isn't the similar kind of taboo here. It does seem like Anthony Bourdain in the documentary film, for example, talks about coming up as a chef in this old school system where the idea was you use everything and you waste nothing. I think about my parents' generation where everything gets stored in the refrigerator until it's used. I mean, what they're terrific at using leftovers. It just seems like there's a – I don't know if it's a generational thing, if it's a cultural thing, and what you make of that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the real strengths of, well, this global movement against food waste, which I and Feedback have had a strong hand in spreading worldwide, is that in most cultures, somewhere deep down in the culinary traditions, the avoidance of waste is absolutely key. And what you just mentioned about Anthony Bourdain, that's what he's talking about. Yeah. Good chefs are taught to squeeze every last thing out of every ingredient. When I did an event in Peru, the chef I was working with turned an onion into three different ingredients using the skin, the inner membrane, and then the flesh of the onion. It's, you know, it's incredible what chefs who are well-trained can do with even things that I would regard as waste. And my favorite moments in my campaigning life have been when I have been outdone at my own game. You just mentioned the time in northwestern China when the chef who I was eating on the roadside cafe came and called me out for leaving 3 grains of rice at the bottom of my bowl. He said, clean.
Yeah.
And I was like, my God, this guy's beaten me. But it happens all the time, and I love it. I did a big event, a disco soup. This is one of the events where we get a load of reclaimed food from the market, bring people together, turn on the music, people have a great party, kind of chopping, preparing, cooking the food, and then sharing it for free as a way of communicating about this issue and building communities around the sharing of food. And there was kind of, if you like, it was in Bulgaria, and the stereotype in my head of a Bulgarian kind of 70-year-old woman, kind of 4.5 foot high, 4.5 foot wide, was standing next to me. And I instructed everyone in the group to take the onions that we had got from the market, and which, you know how they sprout sometimes when they're a bit older and they start shooting the green leaves up and they, you know, get to several inches long. And I said, right, everyone, just peel the onion, tear off the green offshoot and put that in the compost and then chop up the onion. And I heard this Bulgarian woman say something in Bulgarian. I didn't understand a word of it, obviously, but I could tell she was calling me out. She was criticizing me. So I turned to the person to my left and I said, you know, what did she say? And she said, she's telling you, you're wasting the food. That green bit is delicious and we should be chopping it up and putting it in the salad.
Yeah.
I thought, my God, really? And I took a bite and it was sweet. It was like a spring onion, but even sweeter and milder. And yeah, we made a spring onion kind of salad out of these green shoots. And I just, yeah, people who have grown up in a time of scarcity and know the value of every piece of food, it's their instinct to say, yeah, we got to squeeze everything out of this
food.
Well,
Dan Barber points out in the film, the documentary film, that things like bouillabaisse and some of these iconic dishes came from cultures where they took things that were going to be wasted and made beautiful, delicious things.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, my latest initiative is a company called Toast Ale. It's something I founded. It's a for-profit company. We give 100% of our profits to charity, including principally feedback to campaign on this issue globally. And what we're doing is making award-winning craft beer out of bread that would have been wasted. It's made of bread, so of course we call it Toast Ale.
Yeah.
And many people say, well, you know, how do you do that? What an amazing idea. And actually, the ancient origins of beer is fermenting leftover bread and other grains that might have otherwise been wasted because you're preserving the calories. That's what fermentation is for. And so what we've done is really take beer back to its primeval origins. And it's one of the reasons why brewers all over the world have been contacting us to say, look, can we license Toast Ale, produce it here? And, you know, Toast is now available across the UK. We've launched in the northeast of the USA in New York with Whole Foods in July. And we are now going to be spreading out across the USA and indeed around the world. We're already brewing in the UK, in the US, in Brazil, in South Africa, in Iceland, and every week we get a handful of requests. So we're going to set up a platform that allows brewers to license the brand of Toast Ale, to download our expertise and our R&D on producing. I mean, this beer is not, it's not just a nice story. We picked up a silver award, a global craft beer brewing award on blind taste testing.
Yeah.
So just on the quality of the beer. It is a cracking product. And you can drink it whether you know about the backstory or not. But what we're going to do is set up a platform, allow brewers to license the brand, get the recipes, download our expertise, match up with a local source of waste bread, match up with a local nonprofit feeding hungry people with surplus food or other aligned kind of organizations. And that trio will produce Toast Ale together and reap the benefits, turning what is an embarrassment, frankly, at the moment. Food redistribution organizations have a constant headache because they cannot use all of the bread that their donors offer them. There's too much of it.
Yeah.
And everyone in the sector is like, you know, we've done as much as we can making croutons and breadcrumbs, but man cannot live by bread alone. So they realize that this burden, this waste, can now be transformed into something that's seriously enjoyable. And if, as I have, my quest has been to transform the anger and the frustration that I and many others have with this colossal global scandal and transform that into something to celebrate and have a party with and enjoy, I mean, a bottle of beer and there's a slice of bread in every bottle or can of toast ale is just the perfect way of communicating not just the issue of bread waste, but also more generally that we can solve this problem. And indeed, by building communities, by throwing a better party than all the people in the corporations who are wasting food and wasting the planet, that's how we're going to build a community of people globally that are going to be ready to, you know, transform our food system from one that is destroying the planet and destroying human health into one that feeds people nourishing food, looks after the earth, looks after the climate, looks after the soil. That is not an important, in fact, it is an essential transformation for us to make, and we have to take that power into our own hands as consumers and citizens.
That idea of bread is, I think, a good segue into some of the suggestions you make in your book and elsewhere. You know, be prepared before you go shopping. Like, look in the fridge and see what you've got or what you don't have. Avoid being seduced by, you know, marketing gimmicks. Buy the right size, but eat your crusts. Eat the heel of the bread, as we call it here, which that seems like everyone wastes that all over the world.
Yeah, in fact, almost all of our beer in the UK is made from bread that we get, day fresh bread that we get from sandwich manufacturers. We're bonkers about sandwiches in the UK. We eat billions of them every year. And there's a classic example of the upcycling of anger into joy and celebration. Yeah. Is that in 2008, when I first actually got access to a sandwich manufacturer, it's in my TED talk and I put it in my book, 13,000 slices of day fresh bread every single day from one factory, and it's the heel of the loaf, but also the first slice inside the heel, because sometimes it's a slightly different shape. That was 17% of every loaf going into this factory was going into the trash. And, you know, I was in Pakistan that year, 2008. It was the food price spike, and Pakistanis were no longer able to feed their daughters properly because there was a scarcity. And we were contributing to that scarcity through such insane practices. It's always really bugged me. And so when I came across the Belgian brewer in Brussels who was brewing this Babylon beer out of waste bread, I said, this is a killer of an idea. Bread is being wasted industrially all over the world. Craft brewers are worldwide looking for interesting ideas and collaborations. And I've spent the last 10 years building a food waste movement of people who want to do something about it. I'm going to marry up these three global phenomena, and we're going to create a global company that is purely for good. So 100% of our profits go to charity. We've just actually started a round of investment. But, you know, not satisfied with just solving food waste, we're also going to try and solve capitalism. We've set up a new structure for social impact investment called Equity for Good, where all of the money that we generate for our investors, it's their property, but they have to invest it in other good companies or give it to charity. They have to continue to use it for good causes. Mm. So that's a new challenge for us.
I wanted to come back to, you say really that when it comes down to it, this is an expression of our values as a society. Say something about that finally, if you would.
Well, that's right. I mean, my favorite word is companion. Companion means literally somebody you eat bread with. Com is with and pan is bread. And it is through sharing food and building family groups, friendship groups, societal groups that we as humans have always come together around food. It's the most phenomenally powerful social building tool there is. It nourishes us, but it you know, sharing a meal with somebody is symbolic, it's social, it's companionship. And what I have done, what Feedback has specialized in globally, is taking this global problem and transforming it into something that people can be inspired by, to enjoy. And really it's about appreciating the huge bounty that nature brings forth for us as humans every year. And just saying, look, actually, come on, let's cherish this stuff, this food, this embodied land and resources. And that will make us better as people and make us better as a society. And it will solve a lot of the world's big environmental and social problems. And, you know, it is a big issue, but I think it's also a window onto something else. It's a window onto transforming the way in which we see our connection to the material universe and each other. And yeah, it's just a wonderful, wonderful way of doing environmental campaigning, is to organize big and better parties than anyone else.
Tristram Stewart, his book is Waste, Uncovering the Global Food Waste Scandal. He's also featured in a new documentary film called Wasted, The Story of Food Waste, which you can see on demand. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Tristram Stewart joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.